in 1958. Drove an old V8. When we'd gone 100,000, we got out and pushed it a mile. We didn't know who we were, we didn't know what we did. We were just on the road.
Now, if you're listening and you do not know whose voice that is, well, you're in for a great treat, but I'm sure it evokes some great memories for you, as it does with me and my guest Ron Balson, who's here for the next 45 minutes to talk about writing. That is the voice of Bonnie Kolak, and that is the first time anybody in the world listening to a radio has heard her new CD. It's settled, seems like yesterday. It's an amazing Ron Balson. We're not going to spend the whole 45 minutes talking about Bonnie Kolak, but I bet
I bet we could,
couldn't we? You were a big fan, and a lot of people in Chicago sort of revere her. Ron has become a great friend, and also my current favorite novelist, because he keeps turning out these incredibly arresting books. Having come to the business of novel writing relatively late in life, the latest is called The Trust. And, of course, before we get to that, I'm going to do what must happen to you. Whenever you speak, they'll say, Ron, you've had an amazing story. Tell us your story. You wanted to be a writer. You're a lawyer.
Right.
You're practicing attorney, still a practicing
attorney. Been writing legal briefs for 45 years.
Well, there are a lot of other people who can't do what you do who have been writing legal briefs for 45 years, too. But all of a sudden, to backtrack, and you can look up a story that I wrote about Ron about, I think, a year ago, and the kind of amazing second career he started. He wrote a book. He thought it was quite good. It was titled Once We Were Brothers. It was a novel set in pre- and certainly post-war Germany. And deeply set into Chicago, that his wife Monica liked and his kid liked and you liked, and you tried to get someone else to like it, and nobody liked it. Or was willing, not that they didn't like it, they weren't willing to publish it, right?
I couldn't even find a literary agent. I couldn't even get the door open. You know, you can't get to the publishing houses without going through a literary agent, unless you're a famous person, not a first-time fiction writer.
Sure.
So I couldn't even find a literary agent. I got dozens and dozens of rejections.
Nice rejections or
horrible? Well, they come on postcards.
Really?
Postcards. Wow. And they say the same thing. We're not taking on any new authors, or it doesn't suit our needs at this time, or we don't see the viability of this project, or this one's my favorite. I liked it, but I didn't love it.
Oh, for God's sake.
And I came to believe, Rick, and I know it's true, but I can't prove it, that there's a stationery house somewhere that sells pre-printed rejection postcards.
It says that. It's amazing to me that you didn't get depressed to the point where you said, oh, the hell with it, and stick it in a drawer and forget about it. That you did. You had faith in it, and your wife Monica and your son and others in the small circle who read it. You had enough faith to go about the business, and thank God it's contemporary times, to just self-publish the thing, right?
Yeah, I self-published it. I didn't want to let it go. I had worked on it for 3 years. I liked the story. I wanted to see it in print, whether it ever sold a book or didn't sell a book.
Yeah. And so you ordered, 1,000 copies? I don't remember exactly. 500 copies.
You know, I didn't think too far ahead on this. I went to one of the major printing houses outside Ann Arbor, and I ordered the finest paper and the finest cover and all the rest of that. Why not?
Yeah, sure.
And then I found out you can't place an order for 50 books, you know.
That's what you originally wanted, yeah.
So, I had to order 1,000 books, you know.
And you started selling them. Your son helped you, you know, with the modern technology of selling them and online in fashion. And you would sell one or two a month, or 10 a month, and then 15 a month. And then it kind of exploded, right?
In the fall of 2011, for whatever reason, 1,000 books 1 month, 5,000 the next, and pretty soon 100 and some odd thousand, yeah.
And you thought, what about this? You thought, of course, you're an attorney and you're used to researching things deeply. Did you think this was some kind of like publishing miracle? It must have intrigued you, Ron Balson.
Well, I came to realize that books sell by word of mouth. And really for a lot of people, especially people in book clubs and whatnot, you have to ask yourself, how did I come to read the last book? And it's because someone recommended it. Yeah. Like, here we are. You're recommending my book. I think you can do all the marketing and promotion and have all those strategies. I don't think it means as much as your friends recommending a book.
No, I don't think it does either. And you are the living, breathing, best-selling example of that, as far as I'm concerned. You really are. I have rarely, if ever, heard a publishing story that will follow the philosophy of talent will out. This book called Once We Were Brothers, and we'll talk a little bit about it, made its way into the hands of an executive at a publishing firm who then got in touch with you.
That's right. She was home for the Christmas holidays. She's an editor. She was an executive editor at St. Martin's. And home for the Christmas holidays, and her aunt gave her a copy of the book, my self-published book. And she said, I don't have time for this. I've got 6 manuscripts sitting on my desk due by next Friday.
Yeah.
She said, well, just take it. Just take it and look at it. And so she's sitting on the train going back to New York, and the conductor, who she describes as this gruff old curmudgeon, taps her on the shoulder and he says, hey, that's a good book.
And she dug into it and started reading it. And the next thing, she realized how good the book was, called you, made a deal, not just for that book, but for your next book, yes?
Yes. Right.
How did you feel? How empowered? You must have felt at some point, and you too, Monica, his lovely wife sitting in here. You can see her. There's a TV here, so you can see her nodding her head. She doesn't want to come on to talk about the strum and drang of being the wife of a successful novelist. Ron goes, it's boring. It punctuated your faith in your own writing. Yes or no? You're so self-effacing about much of
it. I am self-effacing about it because, you know, it's still hard to get my arms around the fact that so many people are reading my books. Especially when so many people rejected them to begin with.
Sure.
Maybe that's a fallout from
that. Well, the only one hope for me is that all of those so-called agents are smashing their head into the wall saying, I could have. I'm sure they're not, because they would not admit it to their colleagues. I could have had Ron Balson. Once We Were Brothers starts with a real bang here. What I'm trying to do is sell all of Ron's books. We'll talk about The Trust, the latest one, a little later in the show, with a confrontation at the Lyric Opera House with an old, if memory serves, with one old man who works as a starter at the old Waveland, now Merovitz, golf course.
Exactly.
And a billionaire industrialist and philanthropist who the golf starter accuses of having been not his real brother, but very close during the war, and having become a Nazi killer. This grew out of some of your legal traveling especially to Poland.
Right.
Where you, as a Jewish American, didn't know how prominent. I mean, we have the Illinois Holocaust Museum, but living in Chicago, even in many Jewish neighborhoods, you're not daily confronted with the ash of the Holocaust and the war.
Yeah, when you go to Poland, it's unmistakable. You know you're walking on a battlefield. You're walking on a country that ceased to be.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole western half of it was taken and annexed into Germany. The eastern half was to be Lebensraum. It was to be the breathing space for the German people. And Einsatzgruppens, those death squads, were sent in to kill the prominent people and the intellectuals and the wealthy and the whole governmental structure, and the schools were closed, and it ceased to be as a country.
Right.
And if you go there now, and there are monuments, there are memorials everywhere. It's really moving.
It's in the air, and it certainly inspired you. We got to take a little break, but you can listen to the radio. But sometime in the next few hours, do consult ronaldbalson.com. We're gonna talk a little bit about saving Sophie and Carolina's twins. And the latest book, which I finished about 2 weeks ago, called The Trust, which takes place not in Poland or Israel or a little bit Chicago, but in Ireland, in Northern Ireland. Great, great book.
For letting us be here tonight.
Bonnie Kolak, she will be on the radio talking and singing. She'll be talking at 10:30, so stay tuned for that. I'm with Ron Balsam. We're talking about the incredible success of Once We Were Brothers, his first novel that sold, I guess, now hundreds of thousands of copies. That was followed by Saving Sophie, which is set in Israel and Palestine. And then, because you can't, Ron, because it's an emotional thing for you to write about Holocaust-era
events. It's dark. I mean, you sit there for days, and, you know, writing is it's a discipline where you have to sit by yourself and,
sure,
and in a room and write for 5 or 6 hours. And if you're writing about such a dark period, it's it's a difficult thing to do.
Well, the third novel was Carolina's Twins, which was, again, set in Poland. And it was based on another incredible twist of fate, let's say. It was based on a story that you heard from a woman who contacted you after she had read Once We Were Brothers.
Right. She lived in Lincolnwood.
Yeah.
And called me up and said, I'm a survivor, and I've read a lot of books about the war. But when I read your book, I thought I was reading about my own family. You got it just right. And, you know, no author ever gets better praise than that.
No, no kidding. Yeah. No kidding. You must hear all the time when you go to events, because you do a lot of book events and you speak at a lot of book events and you speak to you know, sadly, that crowd of Holocaust survivors is diminishing as we speak. But you must hear at every one of these events from someone, you must sense that you have touched someone in a way that many novelists just can't.
When I speak in areas that had previously a lot of concentration of survivors, because there aren't many left, you'd have to be in your 90s.
Yep.
But a lot of times people would come up, either a survivor or a child of a survivor, and they would want to tell me something about their story, which, you know, personally, I was so honored by that. I mean, sometimes they wouldn't even tell their own families, but they would, you know, they would want to share that. And every one of those stories was unbelievable. Every one has determination and bravery and
courage and survival and heart and
absolutely
love and the will to survive. Carolina's Twins is also flies through time. You're very good at, and you do it in the new book too, of seamlessly wandering through time and making it work.
I think that there's a difference between writing historical fiction, mm-hmm, a novel, and reading a history book, and hopefully the same information is contained in each, but I believe that if you read historical fiction and you get your arms around some characters and you get engaged in the story, that information will stay with you a lot better than it will in a history book.
No question. When you're putting these characters into areas and positions where you know you have enough foundation through your research, there's no question about it in all of your books, are tremendously well-researched. No question about that either. I mean, you've looked at, you know, train schedules and train plots and things.
Yeah, that's
certainly for Carolina's Twins,
that's
which
right
is an astonishing book. Again,
I had to research the train schedules back from the 1940s to determine exactly where that train would have been at specifically that time and whether there would have been wheat fields available when the event happened. Yeah.
Do you think your experience and your background as a lawyer has helped you? It's certainly a great portion of law is research.
I think so. I've always done my own research. And so I'm a litigation attorney.
Yeah.
And so when I'm writing briefs and I'm arguing on what law applies, and yeah, you have to do a lot of research. And
when doing your own research would ingrain in it in your head and make it kind of part of you in a way that, you know, secondhand research would not.
I never trusted secondhand research.
Good for you.
So I don't have a researcher that helps me with my books. I do them all. You know, sometimes I'm asked, so Ron, what are you reading now? What books are you reading? What authors do you like? And I can remember that question being asked while I was writing The Trust, and I said, they said, what book is on your nightstand?
Right.
And I said, it's a 700-page book on the IRA.
We will talk about The Trust right after the commercial. I'm surprised. Well, pretty soon on your nightstand will be the great Tom Weinberg's book about
Monkey
the Lost
God.
City. Monkey God. The Monkey City. The Monkey God. Tom, we're forgetting the name of your book, but it's a great book. That's all we're saying. You are a high school classmate of Ron Paulson's. You're an old, dear friend of mine, and you were actually on the show last week. So there you go. It's all what high school?
Highland Park.
It's all about Highland Park High School, ladies and gentlemen. We got to take a little break, then we'll get some news, and then Ron and I will spend a few minutes talking about The Trust and how this came to be. It's set in Northern Ireland, and it features of one of my I've grown very fond of Liam and his wife. And Liam is a private eye, and his wife's a lawyer, and they live in Chicago. That's why I like him. We'll be back momentarily, and then we'll get some news, and then Ron and I will carry on.
The charmer said, "Why don't you stay? I'll even put the snake away. Your face is pale. Is torn. Why take it off? I will keep
it." Ron Paulson, as if we were, you would think we were two little high school girls listening to Frank Sinatra in 1947. We're like swooning at Bonnie Kolak. She's one of a kind. You'll hear more from Bonnie, and now we have a few more minutes with Ron to talk about. You can go to Ronald Paulson, ronaldbalson.com, to get all sorts of information about his four novels. This one, the seed of this one, where Liam Taggart, a private eye, a married private eye with a small child in Chicago, is compelled back to Ireland, where he spent some interesting years that ended badly. He is back in Ireland trying to deal with a mystery, right? Basically.
Yeah, when I finished writing Carolina's Twins, I told my editor, I want to write a murder mystery now next. And she said, well, that's okay. Go ahead. And I had thought initially I wanted to write the murder mystery about a case that I had had where this young couple, these newlyweds in southern Illinois, were brutally murdered, and no one knew who did it. And there was no reason or no cause or no suspects. And they arrested some shiftless guy, and he spent a lot of years in jail, and finally he got out, and I handled that case. And I thought I'd do that, but then I decided that the case is too close in time and too many people would be identified, and I didn't want to do it. So I was just sitting around trying to think of what to do, and that's a tough time. You finish one book and you don't have something else to work on.
Sure.
I heard John Le Carre on TV not too long ago, a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, 60 Minutes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And he said that he was very depressed when he had finished a book and didn't know what he was going to write next. And it's kind of a funky time.
I'll bet.
Yeah.
I'll bet.
So then one of my kids said, well, why don't you have one about Liam going back to Ireland and investigating a murder? So I said, well, you know, that sounds pretty good. There's a lot of material back in Ireland.
And, oh, no question.
Yeah.
Did you then go to Ireland to do any?
I'll bet
you did, because, again, one of the hallmarks of all of your books is these are historical novels where the history does not beat you on the head. It is seamlessly part of the larger plot, which I so appreciate. I don't feel like I'm getting any kind of history lesson, but I am. I know I'm getting a history lesson.
Yeah, we all knew about the Troubles. I mean,
sure.
we read about it in the paper, and we listened to Reverend Ian Paisley pounding his fist on the podium, and
mm-hmm.
and we saw Jerry Adams come to Washington to see Clinton, and
of
the
course,
big hubbub
sure.
that came. But I didn't really know what was going on.
Yeah.
And I knew that there was bombings and people getting killed, and you know, we would hear.
You knew about the Troubles.
Yeah, right. We'd see the movie The Boxer, and
right.
and we'd hear Nancy
right.
Griffith's song. No place in Ireland a child can go alone, you know. And,
mm-hmm.
and I thought that would, you know, I could draw on that. I could maybe this would be a revenge killing or a vendetta killing coming out of the Troubles, or maybe it's other suspects. And I thought that would make for a good murder mystery.
Well, it sure does. And there is a trust that's been set up and by a person in Ireland who related to Liam. I'm trying not to give like to blow a mystery. I'm not going to.
Well, I think
much.
You can blow that part. That's yeah. just in the first few pages. His
yeah.
uncle dies and sets up a trust and appoints Liam the trustee.
Well, and the point being that the trust cannot be. Are there some bad relatives involved in this mix? This is not. It's not quite a family out of Eugene O'Neill, but there are some bad. There's some good ones too. I mean, you're very creative, Ron, in making this, you know, this strange but compelling family that Liam has to deal with. And he
a lot
has
of disparate personalities.
Yeah, and he has to deal with some ghosts too.
He does.
His
he
own
does.
Demons and ghosts.
Right. He betrayed the family 16 years ago. He's estranged from the family. He didn't want to go back. He gets the call that his uncle has died, and his wife Catherine, she urges him to go back. And not only does he find that his uncle died, but he's been murdered, and that the killer might not be finished.
Yep, and in order for this trust to be disseminated or for the money
distributed,
the killer has to be uncovered.
Yeah, the uncle's specific instructions in the trust were no money was to be distributed to any person until his killer is found and brought to justice.
Yeah.
So the uncle knew he was going to be killed. He knew, but he didn't name his killer.
There's also, you know, in this one, there's also some good, there's been courtroom scenes in some of your previous books. There's a lot of, you know, what I like about this, and I'm sure someone even like Scott Turow or John Grisham would like this, there's some legal stuff going on here, too.
Well, the trust is challenged in the
yeah.
courts,
yeah. Yeah, yeah.
They accuse him, his uncle, of being a lunatic, you know.
What did you think? You must be awfully happy with this book.
I am happy with it. Yeah. I like it a lot.
Do you sense, I mean, if we just look at the arc of your novel writing career, Once We Were Brothers, Saving Sophie, Carolina's Twins, and The Trust, do you sense a more sure hand or sure-footed as you've grown? Because it'd be hard. I could pick a page out of Once We Were Brothers and compare it with this and say, well, this is the same writer. But do you feel a sense of growth as a novelist?
I hope so. I hope
but
my
do you
writing
feel
gets
it?
Better every time. I hope my my sentence structures, the things that you need to do to convey thoughts get better every time. I keep the same main characters from book to book.
Yeah, which is good because
Liam Taggart and
Catherine
Lockhart.
Liam is so into he was I would say in the previous three books, he's a cool guy. Now he is just, there is so much depth added to this guy that even I can understand why Catherine would be in love with him.
One of the things my kid said to me, he said, you know, we really don't know a lot about Liam.
No.
A lot of the books have concentrated on Catherine as the attorney. And
sure.
We don't really know about Liam, so I tried to...
Oh, we know about him now.
Now you know about him.
Well, and you also know not just what he does, but I think you get a real sense in these books of who he is, and I think that's important. So now, Ron Balson, are you at this strange stage that you share with John le Carré of being, after a book, do you know what your next book's going to be, or are you in that weird doldrums?
I'm probably 200 pages into my next book.
Oh, come on.
No,
really?
No, seriously.
Oh, I wanted you to be all angst-filled.
No, Rick, help me.
Are you really?
I put probably, what, 6-7 hours into it today, Monica?
Yeah.
Really? Do you write every day or try to write every day?
I can't because I'm busy doing other things, but I try to.
Wow, it's amazing. Monica, you are a saint because he's a great guy, but it's not easy to be married to a writer. But you now get to travel to some exotic research places. Ron, I am sorry that Bonnie Kolak, because of this horrible weather, could not drive in. Ron brought, as I will tell Bonnie when she comes on by phone at 10:30, Ron brought an old album to have Bonnie autograph. I guarantee you I will get that autograph for you. I will get that autographed, and I will give her one of your books, too. Because her husband, Bob Wolf, is a writer, too, not a novelist.
I brought one for her.
Huh?
I brought one. I brought the trust for her.
Oh, good.
There you go.
It's a good exchange. Ron Balson, it is ever a pleasure to see you, and it is always a pleasure to read you. Monica, you too. You come in
always great being.
It really is. It's a great story, and you've transcended that. You have a great story, but you tell even better stories. So thank you. We'll take a little break, and we'll talk to Chris Chandler about his updated book about Harold Washington and the Civil Rights Legacy. We will be back momentarily.